as the political community or as the state. He was wrong in that. This equation of leader and king and the politicization of the relationship between the leader and those whom he leads. This was the equation of leader and king and the relationship between the leader and those who are led. And that is again equated as a political relationship. These two equations are one. The covenantal community, and believe me, and every Jew should know that, the covenantal community is first and foremost not a political community. You may kill me, I would never admit it. It is a teaching community. The central figure in the covenantal community throughout the ages and millennia was not the king, never the king, nor the warrior or high priest, but the teacher, the rabbi. The people are not subjects, as it is customary in the political community. The people in the covenantal community are disciples. The relationship is not of a political nature. It is not rooted in violence, because any political community must use violence. A political community cannot exist without the use of violence. Nor is it connected with the application of sanctions. It is a free commitment on the part of the disciples to their master and teacher. The latter did not impose any authority upon the disciples. No one asked them to obey his word and to follow him. They can terminate this relationship at any time they decide. You cannot terminate, it's very hard to terminate a political relationship. You know what happened in America during the Civil War, when the Southern states wanted to terminate a political relationship. Judaism has disapproved, basically, of all forms of human government. There are definite streaks, but I want you not to misunderstand me. There are definite streaks of political anarchism in our reluctance to recognize man as king. Man, at best, is a melech avin. And one of the topics of Rosh Hashanah is to contrast melech elyon and melech avin. And by so contrasting, we condemn melech avin. Melech avin is a bluffer, nothing else. A daydreamer. Because there is no Melech Avin. Because Melech Avin is a contradictio in adjecto. God governs. No one else must usurp this prerogative. The only power structure that the Halacha, or Judaism, has accepted is the non-institutionalized relationship prevailing between teacher and pupil within the teaching covenantal community. Moshe is not known to us as king, even though he was king, by Yibishur Melech. He is known as Rebbe, Meshe Rabbeinu. He is known to us as the greatest of all teachers, as the teacher par excellence. The father of all prophets, even though he was also king, warrior, etc. Aaron is not just a high priest. He is the great teacher. Ki sif sekein yish morodaz v'teiro yevak shumipiyem. The priests themselves are not just charismatic personalities. Their sanctity is associated with the teaching they engaged. The disciples love their master and listen not to his orders, since he gives none, but to his teachings, which enlighten their mind and gladden their heart. Moses did not raise himself above the community, as Korach stated and Korach thought, but he was raised by the community above itself. It was raised by the congregation to the exalted heights of a spiritual, not political malchut. And as a matter of fact, spiritual malchut is by far more powerful and more enduring than political malchut. The reflexiforum velomutis nasu is out of context, was wrong. Moses was elevated without questing for leadership. He was not a misnase, but a nasu, or niso. The leader who is the great teacher is the holy man. The teacher is circly elected by God to be near him, and his personal kedusha transcends that of his disciples. Kedusha, there is equation. Kedusha, teaching. The saintly person is the leader, and at the same time, because he is the teacher. Now let us pick up this second argument of Korach. The second argument of Korach has not been mentioned in the Bible. Rashi quotes from Tanhuma and tells us the following humorous story. Omat vikines reish nun roshe sanhedrios vil bishon talistes shekulon tcheres bovu omdu lifne meise omru lei tali shekulo tcheres chayeves bitzitzis epitura amalayan chayeves ischilu vishe kolav efsha tali shol minache chutechot shal tcheres petro zu shekulo tcheres li tifteres atzmo hi atayot kerach 250 chiefs of the court of the Sahara in robes of trillis. Purple, blue, I don't know. Purple wool, let's be purple. Then they came and stood before Moses and said to him, is a garment that is entirely of purple subject to the law of tzitzis, or is it exempt? It is subject to the law, answered Moshe. Moshe was alarmed. Certainly. If they'd asked me, I would also say, subject. Whereupon they began to jeer at him. Is it possible? Is this possible? They asked. A robe of any different colored material, one thread of purple. If you attach one thread of purple, it is exempted from the obligation of tzitzis. And the robe that is entirely of purple should not be exempt. The Midrash tells us another story, which is similar to that of Tcheles. Namely, they ask Moshe a second question. Should one attach a mezuzah to the doorpost of a house filled with scrolls, with Sifrei Torah? Moses answered in the affirmative, of course. They jeered again and said, is it possible the two short sections, Shema Elohim Shomea, are enough in order to exempt the house from the obligation of mezuzah, while a multitude of sifretere does not exempt the house from chivas mezuzah. What is the Medrash out to tell us about these two stories? These stories are similar. They're almost the motif is identical. And what is the Medrash out to tell us? Apparently, the Medrash felt that these two stories which have a touch of sarcasm and humor as well, will reflect the whole philosophy of Kerach and what he wanted. He says, I told you, Terah developed an ideology. He had a substitute for Terah's mission. He wanted to achieve something, because he wanted to take over. But the Medrash wants to bring out, by relating to us, this sarcastically and good-humoredly, these two stories, is, I believe, is obvious. And I would ask people to give me attention, because it's very important. Important as far as our times are concerned. Kerach rebelled against authority. All Jews are equal. Hence, everyone is entitled to interpret the law. It was a question of interpretation of the law. You see, that's why the Midrash introduced the story about the Treles, about the Mezuzah, that Kerach not only wanted political power, he wanted to move Moshe from office and succeed Moshe as king. No! He wanted to succeed Moshe as Rebbe. That generations, countless generations afterward, should say Kerach Rabbeinu. That was his ambition. Yeah, don't sound. That was his ambition, you understand? So hence, he's not only impugned and challenged Moshe's authority as king, political authority, but he challenged his halachic authority. Can Moshe interpret the law? Is Moshe alam? The study of the law, Korach, And to show to the people, to the 250 scholars, the chief justices, that Moshe is incapable of interpreting the law. So he posed to Moshe those two questions. Moshe answered in the affirmative, while the 250 scholars, I don't know, I wouldn't have given them smire, but if 250 scholars have decided that Moshe is wrong, not only Moshe is wrong, they jeered at him, they laughed at him. It was to them nonsense, absurdity. The study of the law, apparently, Kerach argued. The study of the law and its interpretation, Kerach argued, are exoteric acts, democratic acts, in which every intelligent person may engage. Moses' claim to being the exclusive legal authority and exclusive interpreter of the law, Kerach argues, are unfounded and unwarranted. The consequence of such a democratic philosophy is obvious. What Kerach wanted, and what many want even now, and I'm not speaking only about dissident groups, but I'm speaking about the Orthodox community. What Kerach wanted, and what many dissident groups want now, whether they state it clearly, or they use equivocal terms and dubious language to cover it up, is that the instrument of interpretation of the Torah be common sense, or the everyday empirical intelligence, not the esoteric conceptualizing logos which can only be attained through painstaking study and hard training. In Hebrew, we have three terms which signify the human intellectual gesture. You all know Chochma Pinodas. I'm not going to analyze those three terms, but I want to show you just one distinction. Das denotes, particularly in Talmudic language, common sense. Not wisdom, common sense. Sound practical judgment. We come across the expressions Ben Das, was Ben Das me? An average intelligent person, not an idiot. But a nitrofotite, what does nitrofotite mean? He lost his reason, I mean reasonableness. You're correct. A person deprived of Das is an idiot, senseless, foolish. In contradistinction to Das, Chochma Bino refer to scholarship, to specialized knowledge, to a trained logos, to an intellect which was subjected to training and criticism for a long time, to the precise, exact intellect. The Korach group pleaded the case of common sense or Das. They argued that every Jew with common sense should have the right to interpret the laws of the Torah and determine halachic matters in categories of in common sense categories. There are different categories of common sense. As a matter of fact, right there, the ritual committees in the non-Orthodox synagogues, or perhaps even in Orthodox synagogues, employ common sense in reaching halachic decisions. In fact, all the foreign movements, from the Tzedukim during the Second Commonwealth down to religious liberalism of today, pleaded the cause of common sense as the instrument of interpretation. I'll give you an example. The Tzedukim of old said, the Mishneh Yedayim tells us, that the daughter inherits the estate of the father if the son died and left only a daughter. If there is a problem, if there is litigation between the daughter of the father and the granddaughter of the father, then the daughter of the father should get the estate. You know what the Purushim said. Purushim said that if there is litigation between the daughter of the father, of the deceased father, and the granddaughter, who gets the estate? The granddaughter. The Purushim kept on arguing that it would be unjust to discriminate against the legitimate rights of the daughter of the deceased. The Tzedukim kept on arguing that it would be unjust to discriminate against the legitimate rights of the daughter of the deceased if the heir on the opposite side, its opposite number, is also a daughter, but not a daughter of the father, but a daughter of the son. Why should the real daughter surrender the estate to a granddaughter who is not closer, who is not as closely related to the father as she is? What do you say about it? From the viewpoint of common sense, of the exoteric empirical intelligence, the Tzedukim were right. Well, it makes a great deal of sense. In fact, under the aspect of common sense, or the lay practical approach, Kirach's argument against Moshe's decision was also valid. If one purple thread is sufficient, why should a purple garment require tzitzis? If one can fulfill mitzvah mezuzah by attaching two parashiyot to the door, why should not the presence of many scrolls in the house exempt the latter from the need of a mitzvah? However, and this is basically now a trend in the Jewish communities, in Orthodox communities, to introduce common sense as an instrument of interpretation. I know what I'm talking about. Some here, I believe, would understand me. However, Torah Shabbat Peh cannot be identified with common sense, with Das. It is Chochmah. It has a methodology of its own. It has a singular approach. It has a distinct form of analysis. It has its own categories and its own strange schemata. Fundamentally, the Torah Shabbat Peh avails itself of a method of conceptualization. Whoever knows what Torah Shabbat Peh is and the method of teaching Torah Shabbat Peh, particularly the method which was forged by Rabbi Kveger, Chassam Seda, Rabbi Kveger, Kseitz, the Sivis, Rabbi Chaim Brisker. Chaim Brisker actually has developed this method to dizzying heights. Is Lomdes, basically. What do you call Lomdes? Consists in the ability to conceptualize the halacha. We conceptualize Sukkah, we conceptualize Basar D'Cholov, we conceptualize Taruves, we conceptualize the whole Torah. The halacha works like the mathematician in an a priori world. Its constructs are ideal. Torah Shabbat Peh does not study reality. It prepares abstract schemata and applies them to the world of sense. And I'll give you an example. In fact, Aristotle and the entire Greek science, which unfortunately dominated the Western world throughout antiquity and the Middle Ages, failed miserably. Aristotelian physics, I don't say Aristotelian philosophy, Aristotelian logic, but Aristotelian physics failed miserably. You know why? Because its foundation was common sense. The empirical human intelligence, which operates usually with platitudes and commonplace ideas. The great accomplishment of Galileo and Newton consisted in replacing the practical common sense approach with a conceptualizing, creative logos. With that, we all call now the scientific logos. What is scientific logos? What's the difference between scientific logos and the lay logos? Of course, the scientific logos is trained. The lay logos is not trained. Scientific logos is precise. The lay logos is not precise. But what is the main difference? The main difference, the scientific logos conceptualizes reality, while the lay logos, or the common sense logos, takes reality at its face value. They proclaimed the principle, Galileo and Newton, of mathematization and quantification of reality, of converting sense qualities like heat, like light, color, like sound, into quantitative relations, mathematical relations. Now, I'll give you an example. Aristotle, for instance, said, all things fall downward because they are heavy. This, in other words, he considered the gravitational pull as a result of heaviness or weight. Is nonsense. The reverse is true. Weight is the consequence of the gravitational pull. Newton discarded common sense and approached the matter from the viewpoint of the esoteric, abstract, creative, conceptualizing logos, and came up with his famous formula, gravitation equals the product of both masses over the square of the distance. Mm over D, doing the second potency. In other words, gravitational pull is nothing but a mathematical relation between two bodies, which consists of the product of the masses over the square of the distance. This method of quantification was perhaps the greatest discovery in the annals of mankind. Of course, if we had been satisfied, not we, but in the 17th century, had been satisfied with Aristotelian physics, we couldn't climb now to the moon. That's very well. Don't you think that Allah is also entitled to such a prerogative? We have, as I stated above, our unique logical and epistemological approach to Allah. Basically, Torah Sheba'al Peh is not just a compilation of laws. It is a compilation of laws, but it's more than that. Mathematics is not just a corpus of equations. Ask any mathematician who is intelligent, not stupid. What is math? He wouldn't tell you it's a corpus of equations. Or no physicist who understands physics. No physicist will tell you that physics is a collection of natural laws or equations. Basically, science is a method. Mathematics is a method. Physics is a method. It's a method of thinking. A unique logos. So is the Torah Sheba'al Peh. The laws and statutes are of utmost significance. However, if you discard the view that Torah Sheba'al Peh is a system of thought structures and logical categories, unique logical categories, which are accessible to the mind, to the human mind, only if the latter is ready to subject itself to a rigid and tough training, then you open up the floodgate, and any ignoramus may claim authority the way Korach did. I'll give you an example, for instance. You know now the movement of the women leap, right? And the complaints against Torah Sheba'al Peh, against our Allah. Allah has discriminated against the woman. The woman is not an equal of man in Allah. That's what I hear. Many rabbis are ready to surrender, right, in order to please a few ladies of the women leap. Basically, whoever studied Chumash knows Chumash well. Whoever studied the Gemara knows this discharge is sheer libel. Since the Chumash in Bereishis says that God created man, Zohar Nekeva Bore Esau, Bitzalem Elikim Bore Esau, that men and women were created in the image of God, equality is taken for granted. If two persona are created in the image of God, you cannot say one is superior to the other. So people come out always and say, why is women postulators disqualified to bear witness? Disqualification to bear witness is completely, if you speak in terms of Korach, of common sense, or Aristotelian terms of common sense, it's a good argument. Since at a wedding, I'll look for another witness. I'm one witness, kosher ladies. And I look I look for another witness, and I don't find it. Quite often I can't find another witness who is a Shema Mitzvah. And I don't invite a woman to witness the ceremony and sanction the ceremony. Apparently she's inferior to the male. It is not correct. If the Melech HaMashiach were present at the wedding, I wouldn't invite him either, because he's also disqualified to bear witness. But will you say that all Jews are superior to the Melech HaMashiach? King Messiah, king is disqualified to bear witness, like Elisha. Midrash. Will you say that King Messiah, or King David, or King Solomon, or Moshe Rabbeinu himself, who were disqualified to bear witness. I'm never responsible if I can't help it. But would you derive, I mean, the conclusions of it? That David, Moses, and a woodchopper, an ignorant person, a poor midrash, is kosher. If he observes the mitzvahs. Will he say that the psulatus can be translated into axiological terms? And the conclusion would be warranted and justified to say that the king Messiah, the Melech HaMashiach, is inferior to some ignorant Jew? If you operate with common sense categories, yes. Terach operated with common sense categories, then he was right in his conclusion that Atalus Tridus, if the whole robe is made of purple material, certainly should be exempt from the need of Titus. But from the viewpoint of the exact, precise, and unique halachic categories, from the viewpoint of thoughts, halachic thought structure, is Ades has up is not indicative at all of the station of the woman in society, in the halachic community. The same is true about the minyan. We don't count a woman. Does it mean that the woman is inferior? It's very strange, I said it in my yard, that the greatest teacher of all pertaining to prayer was a woman. The Gemara says, if not for Chaneh, we wouldn't be able to pray. So Chaneh was the greatest of all teachers pertaining to prayer. But Chaneh herself couldn't have joined the Minyan. Does it mean that Chaneh was inferior to some ignorant person who was counted among the ten? Not at all. In common sense categories, yes. But in strict halachic categories, in the strict original halachic categories, is the fact that a woman cannot be counted as the tenth person, tenth or the ninth, as a member of the congregation, has absolutely nothing in common with the axiological problem of equality of male and female. The trouble now is that many people, since to be alumni is very hard, and you have to work very hard at it, so many people is ready to exchange alumnis for common sense categories. Now let me explain. The adherents of the common sense halacha, no matter what they call it, so they call it meaningful halacha, creative halacha, new halacha, I mean, there are quite a variety of terms. I'm never impressed by terms and cliches. But actually what they want is common sense halacha. Are misled by a basic philosophical doctrine containing half-truth and platitudes. They expound, since the days of Kerach, more or less a theory of religious subjectivism. Prima facie, it is hard to refute this theory. It was, as I told you, it was hard to refute Korach's argument of Kechol Eid HaKol HaMelechem. Because both arguments contain a kernel of truth. They say, and you probably heard it quite often, Rachmon Elibe Boy, God is interested in the heart, in man's inner world. Faith, fundamentally, is an inner experience. Man they say, meet God in the mysterious recesses of his personality. The God experience is iridescent, dynamic, bold, and break through the exterior of the human personality and turns into objective deeds, into action. In a word, they claim, and this is the theory, the philosophy of religious subjectivism, which is so popular now in the United States. I mean, it's known under the name and the trademark of existentialism, religious existentialism. In a word, they say the mitzvot manifest an inner mood, a spiritual quest, a hidden feeling of happiness or sadness. The mitzvot are supposed to reflect the inner experience. The mitzvot, according to them, are external correlates which run parallel to the experiential order. Each experience has its external correlate in the form of action. If this theory, they argue, is correct, then the mitzvot have got to correspond to the mood which they are supposed to express in the most competent way. Hence, the mitzvot must avail themselves of the media of expression which are best fitted to reflect the inner experience. And they argue, the scholars live in a world of abstractions, cannot determine the redemptive power of mitzvot. Only a common sense approach is capable of gauging the therapeutic energy of each mitzvah and to utilize it in the most efficient manner. Korach said to Moses, the blue thread was meant as a reminder to make us think of something, of distance, infinity, of the mysterious link between the blue sea and the blue sky. Why is it necessary to limit this symbolism to a thread and not extend it to the whole garment? From the standpoint, again, of common sense, Halacha Kirach was right. A beautiful purple robe may have a greater impact upon the individual than a single thread. I agree with the preamble of this theory, always the preamble of the theory, that there are two parallel religious orders in Judaism, the objective and the subjective. Judaism, in my opinion, consists of two things, divine disciplines, call it Shulchan Aruch, or any other name, and the great romance between finitude and infinity, between God and man. We have a score in our Tanakh, in our canon, which deals exclusively with this great romance, human Shirasha. Both deed and experience are inseparably united. The deed without experience is an incomplete act, an imperfect gesture, no doubt about it. As a matter of fact, whatever I say in this context is correct from the viewpoint of strict halachic thinking. The question is, it's very easy to say, Judaism consists of a double order, of an external order of action, of deeds, or divine disciplines, and an inner experience, or an inner feeling of love for HaKadosh Baruch Hu, for God. The question is, you have to prove it. Is Allah cognizant of experiential moments? I mean, the problem is, you cannot just say, because I like it, or because if I like it, or people will come to listen to me. How can we prove it that Allah is interested in experience? Exactly. because certain mitzvahs consist in experience. And I am not referring to the mitzvah of love of God or the mitzvah of love of man. I am referring to ritual mitzvahs. For instance, the Kriyashma. Kriyashma, even though it is strictly identified with the recital of a certain fixed and standardized text, however, the Tima mitzvah is Kiyum Balev, is an experience. The same is true of Tefillin, Avedim Shalev. The same most probably is true of Avelis. The same is true of Simchas Yontov. Notwithstanding the halachic requirement for the recital of standardized text or the observance of external rites, the mitzvahs are consummated, like Avelis, Krishna, Tefillin, and realized in an experience. In other words, even the formal abstract halacha knows of the experience as an important part of the religious gesture. However, and here we reach the boundary, the religious experience is not the primary gesture. It is the secondary. The point of departure must never be the inner subjective experience. No matter how redemptive it is, no matter how colorful it is, no matter how therapeutic it is, no matter how great the impact the experience has upon the total personality of man, it should never be the point of departure. The point of departure must always be the objective external act. The objective act does not symbolically express or interpret the experience. Here they made a mistake. The reverse is true. The experience interprets the act. There are a variety of reasons justifying our thesis concerning the supremacy of the act over the feeling. The supremacy of the solid religious reality or over the emotion. First reason is the religious emotion is changeable, volatile, and transient, like any other emotion. Second, each individual experiences God, man, and the world at a religious level in a unique fashion. If the religious act would have to adjust itself to the inner feelings of man, we would have to invent a constantly changing ritual. What the appropriate medium is today will be absolute, or the appropriate medium of expression is today will be obsolete tomorrow. What is good for me does not behoove my next door neighbor. There would be, if the religious experience were the point of departure and the religious act would have to correspond to the experience, there would be a variety of symbolic actions. We could not speak of a monistic service of God. This kind of ever-changing worship is idolatrous, basically. Interesting is the Rashi in Kerach. Roma Meishele Kerach. If the Kechovim Yeshlem Elohu Sarve, the pagans have many gods. Keanim Harve, many priests. Bavedis Harve, in many forms of worship. Onu Yeshlonu Kerachot, we have one god. Keanachot, one high priest. Bavedoachas, one form of worship. Monistic worship is constant. And monistic worship is not exposed to the winds of change. There is another reason for giving priority to the act over the experience. It is simply impossible to determine what is what and who is who. we can never determine what is a religious experience in contradistinction to a hedonic, mundane experience. We know of many non-religious emotions, hedonic emotions, which are provided with enormous power. They are hypnotic and at first glance redemptive. One may easily confuse the religious drive with the love impulse. It is quite normal to replace the religious ecstatic craving with the aesthetic yearning of the artist. There are common characteristics in both of them. The quest for exaltedness and infinity is typical of both, of the experience of beauty and the religious experience. To substitute secular for religious emotions is again an idolatrous method. The pagans of old used to indulge in hypnotic orgiastic ceremonials and mistakenly identifying them with the religious experience. The Torah prohibited idolatrous practices to be introduced in the ritual and service of God. Echo Yavdu Agim Oil Sanayem, Vese King Amoni, Leisase King of the Shemakeho. How did these nations serve their gods? Even so will I do likewise. Thou shalt not do so unto the Lord thy God. The Torah had exactly in mind the idolatrous, uninhibited, frenzied, hedonic experiences which the pagans engaged into, confusing them with the religious experience. The rousing of religious awareness by confronting it with the powerful hypnosis of the aesthetic experience, such as music, plastic arts, architecture, is alien to Halachic Judaism. For instance, take the organ as an instrument. What's the purpose of the organ? What's the purpose of the organ? There is the organ serves a purpose. What's the purpose of the organ? Prepare a mood. Yeah. The organ does not prepare a religious mood, because the organ itself is an instrument not of religious experience, but of the artistic experience. So use an artistic experience in order somehow to pave the way for religious mood. The religious mood will never come. The way will be paved by an aesthetic experience. The same is true if you dance. The dance may rouse it personally. Of course. Yes, it's stimulating. The rhythm itself is intoxicating. But all the rhythm of dancing is a secular experience. It's not a religious experience. It's an aesthetic experience. You expect that the aesthetic experience will pave the way for a religious experience which will follow the aesthetic experience. That will never happen. Will never happen then. Particularly, and that is basically idolatrous. And in my opinion, that is the real reason for the elimination of the organ from the service, or the non-introduction of the organ into the service. Yehudus wanted, and I'll tell you so what, that the religious experience be born in a world of its own, not stimulated or roused by a secular, mundane, hedonic experience. And of course, and if we use as a stimulate the love experience, then it becomes abominable. This is idolatry par excellence. The religious experience is born within the religious awareness, not under the pressure of physiological carnal drives, not even provoked by spiritual needs of the human personality, such as the need for beauty. The same purpose serve the architecture of the cathedrals in the Middle Ages, in particular the Gothic architecture. I mean, whoever is acquainted with Spengler's book, I mean, The Decline of the Urban of the Western World, the West, how he interprets and he's writing that the Gothic experience, the Gothic cathedral, wanted to arouse in the human personality, I mean, the experience of infinity, of boundlessness, of questing, I mean, up into the heavens. Of course, perhaps it may actually provoke such an experience, produce such a quest, but it is an artistic quest, it is not a religious quest. And to substitute an artistic quest for a religious quest is idolatrous. You know very well, never mind it, now people speak about architecture of synagogues. There was no architecture of synagogues. We never cared about it. The Jewish synagogue was a plain home. We never tried to influence the Jew by bringing him into surroundings suggesting a transcendental order or otherworldliness. We never tried to do it. Catholics, yes. The whole mass, the music, I mean, the architecture, I mean, are geared to that purpose, to stimulate the person an aesthetic experience, hoping that by this stimulation, the worshipper will also be aroused to a religious experience. And this is correct. This is absolutely wrong. The religious experience is autonomous, free and original, moves at its own tempo, within its own unique orbit. This kind of independent experience follows, you know when? Follows the deed instead of preceding it. To pray, and after prayer, to engage in a dance or in a song, it's okay. However, to dance in order to pray is futile, because one will never pray. The Yahadus expected the religious experience to follow the religious act. The great romance follows the divine disciplines, not the reverse. Misha said, if one fulfills mitzvah tzitzis, then a glance at the thread, at the purple thread, will produce in him perhaps the experience of infinity. If you proceed from action to experience, then the purple color will remind you of the mystery of existence and our link with God. However, if one fails to conform to the halachic norm and contrary to the rules of halacha avails himself of a common sense approach, the looking or the glancing at the trailers will not produce any reaction. And if a response will be forthcoming, it will be a mundane hedonic response, not a religious response. It will not enhance my religious experience. Blue, the experience of blue, if it follows the Kiyuma Mitzvah, is a great experience. But the experience of blue, without the Kiyuma Mitzvah, can produce him a vulgar association, vulgar memories, unredeemed experiences. When I hear people talk about meaningful halacha, the unfreezing of the halacha, empirical halacha, I know what the people have in mind, by all the jargon. They have in mind exactly what Kerach and his adherents had when they approached Moses with the problem of Talish Kulatredes. They wanted a common sense interpretive approach to halacha. They simply had no patience to study, to get the proper training, and to master the unique halachic methodology and logic. They rebelled against the institution of Lomdes. They want to do to halacha what Aristotle did to physics, to convert it into a shallow discipline, replete with platitudes and commonplace ordinary opinions. Of course, Moshe won. The Kera group finally admitted that Moshe MS with Rosh MS. We still study the halacha in light of Moshe's esoteric conceptualizing logic. The Masora of method of halachic structures and a priori constructs will continue forever. Viktor Orlov, Ktira Samim, Babaker, Betives, Aneres, Yakterenel, Uba Aleisarines, Aneres, Ben Arboim, Yakterenel. And Aaron shall burn thereon incense. Every morning he dresses the candles, he shall burn it. And when Aaron lights the candles, the lamps, at dusk, he shall burn it. The burning of the incense and the lighting of the lamps have been merged by the Torah in the one mitzvah. As a matter of fact, whoever studies Scotchin, no Scotchin well knows that there is a separate view of combining that locus on earth with actoras on earth. There is a separate view of lighting the candles almost simultaneously with the burning of the Torah. What does that locus on earth signify? Light, understanding, knowledge of the Torah, clarity of concept, and the depth of halachic analysis, the clear deed, the intelligent performance. What does Kteres represent? The hidden and the intimate, the mysterium magnum of creation, and the mysterium tremendum of divine presence in creation and beyond. The chisson and Kteres as a kateres, and the cloud of incense. Incense may cover the ark. Kteres tells us a great story of human craving for God, his questing and yearning for the origin. For the makor, for the beginning of all, Kteres, the symbol, tells us a marvelous story of human tragic waiting for an ecstatic unity with the Almighty. The colorful religious experience is represented by Kteres. The clear, intelligent religious thought and intelligent action is represented by the candles, by the menorah. The Torah, however, admonished us that the burning of the incense be coordinated with the lighting, the mystery of healing, with the clarity of thinking and acting, the excitement and passion of craving be united with the serenity and peace of halachic comprehension and halachic implementation. Both are necessary. Yes, there is a parallel order of experience and deed, of romance and discipline, of thought and feeling. Yes. Necessary. Yet Kteres cannot be separated from Adlokas Aneres. The subjective must never be isolated from the objective. And the Urisemes in Schartem cannot be severed from the Psilchiles. The halachic detail and halachic precision is necessary if one wants to attain the great colorful religious experience.